Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from inks to iridescence. Today, we'll look at the chemistry of the printed page. We'll take a tour of the Chemical Heritage Foundation's Rare Books Library and experiment with invisible inks. That's all coming up on Distillations. The Chemical Heritage Foundation's Roy G. Neville Historical Chemical Library is home to approximately 6,000 volumes from the late 15th to the early 20th century, including many of the most important works in the history of science and technology. Many of the works written before 1800 are especially rare, and some 400 titles are the only known copies in the world. These priceless books are old and fragile, and must be maintained at precise temperatures and humidity. Besides containing thousands of pages of text, many of the books contain striking illustrations, some in black ink, but others in lush reds, greens, and blues. How did the printers of yesteryear make such bold colors? The answer for one of these hues is in today's Element of the Week. CHF's Audra Wolf has more.
The element copper is everywhere, in pots and pans, roofs and gutters, electronics and medical devices. It's even in our bloodstream. But one of the oldest and most interesting uses for copper is in creating the color green. Buildings made with copper will take on a greenish tint over time. This is caused by oxidation, the effect of air reacting with the metal to form a patina. In the days before synthetic pigments, copper was a key ingredient in the artist's palette, used in paintings as well as illuminated manuscripts. The most common green pigment, verdigris, was made by suspending strips of copper above a bowl of warm vinegar, or, in wine-growing regions, by placing grape skins on copper plates. The copper reacted with the acetic acid to make copper acetate, which was then scraped off and ground into a powder. The green-blue pigment was often called Greek or Spanish green. Another pigment made from copper is malachite, a deep green color ground from the ore of copper carbonate. This method was very popular in the 15th and 16th centuries, and the resulting color was often used in Renaissance art. Later, in the early 1800s, emerald or Paris green was prepared from verdigris and copper arsenite, an arsenic compound, which resulted in one of the deadliest poisons ever used in painting. While some artists were using this tint in wallpaper, the French were rumored to use it as a rat poison. The color was discontinued after it was blamed for a number of human deaths. All three dyes were eventually replaced due to their toxicity. Now, most green pigments get their color from chromium, but that's an element for another show. I'm Audra Wolf with the Element of the Week.
We know that chemistry can be used to create and preserve books, but how do conservators actually conduct this delicate work? CHF's Ron Brashear toured the Roy G. Neville Historical Chemical Library with Glenn Ruzicka from the Conservation Center for Art and Historic Artifacts.
I'm Ronald Brashear. I'm the director of the Othmer Library of Chemical History at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Glenn and I are going to go back into the rare book room, and I'm going to show him some examples of books here in our rare book library. So let's take a look at one in particular here. Let me open up the case. Not only do we keep these behind locked doors, but we keep them in locked cabinets as well. So I've got a 17th century volume by Georgius Agricola, De Re Metallica. You can see in this case, whereas the paper, when it was first produced, is white, by the time you have the printer's ink placed on them, you can see how the ink has made the white paper brown, much different than in the margins of the book, which remain to some extent white.
What's different about printing inks and actually how much sizing there was, so how much how the ink was made and the formulation of the ink, so that could vary the amount of dispersion of ink through the page, and also the pre-treatment of the page before the printing, because it had to be wet out, softened somewhat to accept the ink. So that can also create a situation where the paper discolors over time.
Well, what I'd like to show you right now is I've got a manuscript here by Isaac Newton.
Oh.
And unlike the book we just looked at, for instance, of course, this is a handwritten manuscript. So in this case, now we have a different kind of ink. This is probably, I would imagine, an iron gall ink, mm-hmm. which was standard at the time, on handmade paper. Now, I understand iron gall ink, especially if it's thickly applied, can actually eat away at the paper. And it looks like, in some cases, here there are a couple of dark spots where it's mm-hmm. like Newton dripped some ink on the paper, and even one place here where it may have eaten through but been repaired.
These actually look very good. And we have a couple of different letters here, and you can see that the there is a variation in the ink. It's a very different compound than the printer's ink. I've read that in the 15th century there were thousands of recipes for iron gall ink. It's something that you could make, and it's a simple compound. But it's very different than printer's ink in that it's based on a chemical reaction between the gallic acid from the oak galls. Combine that with iron sulfate and water and gum arabic as a suspension. And it's real quality, and the reason that people liked it, well, there were a number of things. One, it was a lot finer than carbon. Two, you could use it in a watery suspension, so it ran like ink. It wasn't a thick oil. And three, that chemical reaction actually bites into the paper, so it's indelible. It can't really be erased. And it also works on parchment. A byproduct of that chemical reaction is sulfuric acid. Which basically eats into the paper.
Well, conservation practices have really become much more sophisticated. I understand now the basic practice in conservation is to really try to be as sensitive to the materials as possible, to do nothing that can't be undone
yes.
at some time. So the materials you use are probably much different now than may have been in past years.
Right. In some ways, we're more conservative in the treatments and in the applications of treatment. One of the things you find as a conservator treating artifacts that a good portion of what you do is undoing what people have done before to preserve that artifact, using tapes, mounting prints to boards. A very common treatment for iron gall ink manuscripts in the late 19th and early 20th century was silking, where they would put glue on the manuscript and apply thin layers of silk to either side to support it. But that silk is naturally acidic and is not long-lasting and deteriorates. So we do a certain amount of removing silking, using enzymes to remove the glue, and then following up with the treatments that I described.
Well, thanks, Glenn. I really appreciate your coming in to give us a little more insight into what's going on, what chemical reactions are going inside these rare books when we're not looking.
Sure. It's great. It's nice to be here, and it's always a lot of fun to look at great books.
So I'll lock it up now. Safe and secure.
You can learn more about using chemistry for book restoration and preservation, including a recipe for iron gall ink, on our website, distillations.chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. In today's episode, we've heard about chemical processes for creating and preserving inks. But what if you wanted to create a secret text? One that will appear visible for a short period of time and then disappear, leaving no evidence of correspondence. In this week's Chemistry in Your Cupboard, CHF historian Anke Timmerman introduces us to the long history of invisible inks.
More than 2,000 years ago, Ovid wrote of using the milk of the Tithymilus plant to write secret love letters in his poem, The Art of Love. In more modern times, secret ink has also been used for political intrigue. In Berlin, visitors to the Stasi Museum can learn how the East German secret police passed secret messages using cerium oxalate carbon papers and a special chemical developing process with a solution of manganese sulfate, hydrogen peroxide, and other chemicals. When the carbon papers were developed with the correct solution, the secret messages were revealed. You don't need a chemistry lab to make your own inks at home. In fact, chances are good you have all the ingredients you need to create secret ink in your own kitchen. Try writing a message with lemon juice, onion juice, vinegar, or milk, on a plain piece of paper, then let it dry. The letters vanish. But simply heat up the paper over a candle, with an iron or in the oven, and the writing becomes visible. The acid in each of these substances reacts with the paper, leaving it slightly thinner. As a result, the letters burn more quickly than the surrounding fresh paper, leaving a scorched trail of writing. You could also try writing with a laundry detergent with optical brighteners, a common ingredient in most detergents. This time, you'll need a UV light source, like a black light, to reveal your message. And that's it for today's Chemistry in Your Cupboard. I'm Anke Timmermann.
And that's it for this episode of Distillations. This week's quotation is famously attributed to Vladimir Nabokov. The pages are still blank, but there is a miraculous feeling of the words being there, written in invisible ink and clamoring to become visible. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.